could taste the salt spray on his lips. A sudden gust of wind made him lose his footing, and he stumbled to his knees. Asher helped him rise.
"You can't hold your wine either, brother."
Theon leaned on her shoulder and let her guide him across the rain-slicked boards.
"I liked you better when you were Eskred,"
he told her accusingly. She laughed.
"Well, that's fair. I liked you better when you were 9.
Brain. It was Hyle Hunt who insisted that they take the heads. "Tarly will want them for the walls," he said. "We have no tar," Brain pointed out. "The flesh will rot. Leave them." She did not want to travel through the green gloom of the piney woods with the heads of the men she'd killed. Hunt would not listen. He hacked through the dead men's necks himself, tied the 3 heads together by the hair and slung them from his saddle. Brain had no choice but to try and pretend they were not there, but sometimes, especially at night, she could feel their dead eyes on her back, and once she dreamed she heard them whispering to one another. It was cold and wet on Cracklaw Point as they retraced their steps. Some days it rained, and some days it threatened rain. They were never warm. Even when they made camp, it was hard to find enough dry wood for a fire. By the time they reached the gates of Maidenpool, a host of flies attended them. A crow had eaten Shagwell's eyes, and Pig and Timian were crawling with maggots. Brain and Podrick had long since taken to riding 100 yards ahead to keep the smell of rot well behind them. Sir Hyle claimed to have lost all sense of smell by then. "Bury them," she told him every time they made camp for a night. But Hunt was nothing if not stubborn. He will most like tell Lord Randall that he slew all 3 of them. To his honour, though, the knight did nothing of the sort. "The stammering squire threw a rock," he said, when he and Brain were ushered into Tarly's presence in the yard of Mouton's castle. Their heads had been presented to a sergeant of the guards, who was told to have them cleaned and tarred and mounted above the gate. "The swords wench did the rest." "All 3? Lord Randall was incredulous. The way she fought, she could have killed 3 more. "And did you find the Stark girl?" Tarly demanded of her. "No, my lord. Instead you slew some rats. Did you enjoy it?"
"No, my lord."
"A pity. Well, you've had your taste of blood, proved whatever it is you meant to prove. It's time you took off that mail and donned proper clothes again. There are ships in port. One's bound to stop at Tarth. I'll have you on it."
"Thank you, my lord, but no."
Lord Tarly's face suggested he would have liked nothing better than to stick her own head on a spike and mount it above the gates of Maidenpool with Timian, Pig and Shagwell. "You mean to continue with this folly?"
"I mean to find the Lady Sansa."
"If it please my lord," Sir Hyle said, "I watched her fight the mummers. She is stronger than most men and quick." "The sword is quick," Tarly snapped. "That is the nature of Valyrian steel." "Stronger than most men?" "Aye. She's a freak of nature. Far be it from me to deny it." "His sort will never love me," Brain thought, "no matter what I do. My lord, it may be that Sandor Clegane has some knowledge of the girl. If I could find him..." "Clegane's turned outlaw. He rides with Beric Dondarrion now, it would seem. Or not. The tales vary. Show me where they're hiding. I will gladly slit their bellies open, pull their entrails out, and burn them. We've hanged dozens of outlaws, but the leaders still elude us. Clegane, Dondarrion, the Red Priest, and now this woman, Stoneheart. How do you propose to find them when I cannot?"
"My lord, I..."
She had no good answer for him. "All I can do is try." "Try then. You have your letter. You do not need my leave. But I'll give it, nonetheless. If you're fortunate, all you get for your trouble are saddle sores. If not, perhaps Clegane will let you live after he and his pack are done raping you. You can crawl back to Tarth with some dog's bastard in your belly." Brain ignored that.
"If it please, my lord, how many men ride with the hound?"
6 or 60 or 600. It would seem to depend on whom we ask." Randall Tarly had plainly had enough of the conversation.
He started to turn away. If my squire and I might beg your hospitality until...
Beg all you want. I will not suffer you beneath my roof.
Sir Hiel Hunt stepped forward. If it please my lord, I had understood that it was still Lord Mouton's roof.
Tarly gave the knight a venomous look. Mouton has the courage of a worm. You will not speak to me of Mouton. As for you, my lady, it is said that your father is a good man. If so, I pity him. Some men are blessed with sons, some with daughters. No man deserves to be cursed with such as you.
Live or die, Lady Brain. Do not return to Maidenpool whilst I rule here.
Words are wind. Brain told herself, they cannot hurt you. Let them wash over you.
As you command, my lord, she tried to say, but Tarly had gone before she got it out. She walked from the yard like one asleep, not knowing where she was going. Sir Hiel fell in beside her.
There are inns.
She shook her head. She did not want words with Hiel Hunt.
Do you recall the stinking goose?
Her cloak still smelled of it.
Why?
Meet me there on the morrow at midday. My cousin Alan was one of those sent out to find the hound. I'll speak with him.
Why would you do that?
Why not? If you succeed where Alan failed, I shall be able to taunt him with that for years. There were still inns in Maidenpool. Sir Hiel had not been wrong. Some had burned during one sack or the other, however, and had yet to be rebuilt, and those that remained were full to bursting with men from Lord Tarly's host. She and Podrick visited all of them that afternoon, but there were no beds to be had anywhere.
"Sir, my lady,"
Podrick said, as the sun was going down, "there are ships. Ships have beds. Hammocks or bunks." Lord Randall's men still prowled the docks as thick as the flies that had been on the heads of the three bloody mummers, but their sergeant knew Brain by sight and let her pass. The local fisherfolk were tying up for the night and crying the day's catch, but her interest was in the larger ships that plied the stormy waters of the narrow sea. Half a dozen were in port, though one, a galleass called the Titan's Daughter, was casting off her lines to ride out on the evening tide. She and Podrick Payne made the rounds of the ships that remained. The master of the Gulltown Girl took Brain for a whore and told them that his ship was not a bawdy house, and a harpooner on the Ebonese Whaler offered to buy her boy, but they had better fortune elsewhere. She purchased Podrick an orange on the Sea Strider, a cog just in from Old Town by way of Tyrosh, Pentos, and Duskendale. "Gulltown next," her captain told her. "Then surround the fingers to Sisterton and White Harbour if the storms allow. She's a clean ship, Strider, not so many rats as most, and will have fresh eggs and new-churned butter aboard. Is my lady seeking passage north?"
"No,
not yet." She was tempted, but as they were making their way to the next pier, Podrick shuffled his feet and said,
"Sir, my lady, what if my lady did go home? My other lady, I mean, sir, Lady Sansa?"
"They burnt her home. Still, that's where her gods are, and gods can't die."
"Gods cannot die, but girls can.
Timian was a cruel man and a murderer, but I do not think he lied about the hound. We cannot go north until we know for certain. There will be other ships." At the east end of the harbour, they finally found shelter for the night aboard a storm-wracked trading galley called the Lady of Mir. She was listing badly, having lost her mast and half her crew in a storm, but her master did not have the coin he needed to refit her, so he was glad to take a few pennies from Brian and allow her and Pod to share an empty cabin. They had a restless night. Thrice Brian woke, once when the rain began, and once at a creak that made her think Nimble Dick was creeping in to kill her. The second time she woke with knife in hand, but it was nothing. In the darkness of the cramped little cabin, it took her a moment to remember that Nimble Dick was dead. When she finally drifted back to sleep, she dreamed about the men she'd killed. They danced around her, mocking her, pinching at her as she slashed at them with her sword. She cut them all to bloody ribbons, yet still they swarmed around her. Shagwell, Timian, and Pig, aye, but Randall Tarly, too, and Vargo Hoat, and Red Ronnet Connington, Ronnet had a rose between his fingers. When he held it out to her, she cut his hand off. She woke sweating,
and spent the rest of the night huddled under her cloak, listening to rain pound against the deck over her head. It was a wild night. From time to time she heard the sound of distant thunder and thought of the Brevosi ship that had sailed upon the evening tide. The next morning she found the stinking goose again, woke its slatternly proprietor, and paid her for some greasy sausages, fried bread, half a cup of wine, a flagon of boiled water, and two clean cups. The woman squinted at Brian as she was putting the water on to boil.
"You're a big one went off with Nimble Dick. I remember. He cheat you?
No.
Rape you?
No.
Steal your horse?
No. He was slain by outlaws.
Outlaws?
The woman seemed more curious than upset.
I always figured Dick would hang or get sent off to that wall.
They ate the fried bread and half the sausages. Podrick Payne washed his down with wine-flavoured water, whilst Brian nursed a cup of watered wine and wondered why she'd come. Hyle Hunt was no true knight. His honest face was just a mama's mask. "I do not need his help, I do not need his protection, and I do not need him," she told herself. "He is probably not even coming. Telling me to meet him here was just another jape." She was getting up to go when Sir Hyle arrived. "My lady, Podrick." He glanced at the cups and plates and the half-eaten sausages cooling in a puddle of grease and said, "Gods, I hope you did not eat the food here." "What we ate is no concern of yours," Brian said. "Did you find your cousin? What did he tell you?" "Sandor Clegane was last seen in salt pans the day of the raid. Afterward he rode west along the Trident." She frowned. "The Trident is a long river."
"Aye,
but I don't think our dog will have wandered too far from its mouth. Westeros has lost its charm for him, it would seem. At Salt Pans he was looking for a ship." Sir Hyle drew a roll of sheepskin from his boot, pushed the sausages aside and unrolled it. It proved to be a map. "The Hound butchered three of his brother's men at the old inn by the crossroads, here. He led the raid on Salt Pans, here." He tapped Salt Pans with his finger. "He may be trapped. The Freys are up here at the Twins. Daddy and Harrenhal are south across the Trident. West, he's got the Blackwoods and the Brackens fighting, and Lord Randall's here at Maidenpool. The high road to the Vale is closed by snow, even if he could get past the mountain clans. Where's a dog to go?" "If he is with Dundarian?" "He's not. Alan is certain of that. Dundarian's men are looking for him too. They have put out the word that they mean to hang him for what he did at Salt Pans. They had no part of that. Lord Randall is putting it about that they did in hopes of turning the commons against Beric and his brotherhood. He will never take the Lightning Lord so long as the small folk are protecting him. And there's this other band led by this woman, Stoneheart, Lord Beric's lover, according to one tale. Supposedly she was hanged by the Freys, but Dondarrion kissed her and brought her back to life, and now she cannot die, no more than he can." Brian considered the map. If Clegane was last seen at Salt Pans, that would be the place to find his trail. "There is no one left at Salt Pans but an old knight hiding in his castle," Alan said. "Still, it would be a place to start." "There's a man," Sir Hyle said, "a septon. He came in through my gates the day before you turned up. Meribald, his name is, riverborn and riverbred, and he served here all his life. He's departing on the morrow to make his circuit, and he always calls at Salt Pans. We should go with him." Brain looked up sharply. "We? I am going with you." "You're not." "Well, I'm going with Septon Meribald to Salt Pans. You and Podrick can go wherever you bloody well like. Did Lord Randall command you to follow me again?" "He commanded me to stay away from you. Lord Randall is of the view that you might benefit from a good, hard raping." "Then why would you come with me?" "It was that or return to gate duty." "If your lord commanded, he is no longer my lord." That took her aback. "You left his service?" "His lordship informed me that he had no further need of my sword or my insolence. It amounts to the same thing. Henceforth I shall enjoy the adventuresome life of a hedge knight. Though if we do find Sansa Stark, I imagine we will be well rewarded. Gold and land, that's what he sees in this.
I mean to save the girl, not sell her. I swore a vow. I don't recall that I did. That is why you will not be coming with me. They left the next morning as the sun was coming up. It was a queer procession, Sir Hyle on a chestnut courser and Brian on her tall grey mare, Podrick Payne astride his sway-back stot, and Septon Meribald walking beside them with his quarterstaff, leading a small donkey and a large dog. The donkey carried such a heavy load that Brian was half afraid its back would break. "Food for the poor and hungry of the Riverlands," Septon Meribald told them at the gates of Maidenpool. "Seeds and nuts and dried fruits, oaten porridge, flour, barley bread, 3 wheels of yellow cheese from the inn by the Fool's Gate, salt cod for me, salt mutton for dog, oh, and salt, onions, carrots, turnips, 2 sacks of beans, 4 of barley, and 9 of oranges. I have a weakness for the orange, I confess. I got these from a sailor, and I fear they will be the last I'll taste till spring." Meribald was a septon without a sept, only one step up from a begging brother in the hierarchy of the faith. There were hundreds like him, a ragged band whose humble task it was to trudge from one fly-speck of a village to the next, conducting holy services, performing marriages, and forgiving sins. Those he visited were expected to feed and shelter him, but most were as poor as he was, so Meribald could not linger in one place too long without causing hardship to his hosts. Kindly innkeeps would sometimes allow him to sleep in their kitchens or their stables, and there were septeries and holdfasts, and even a few castles where he knew he would be given hospitality. Where no such places were at hand, he slept beneath the trees or under hedges. "There are many fine hedges in the Riverlands," Meribald said. "The old ones are the best. There's nothing beats a 100-year-old hedge. Inside one of those, a man can sleep as snug as at an inn, and with less fear of fleas." The septon could neither read nor write, as he cheerfully confessed along the road, but he knew 100 different prayers and could recite long passages from the 7-pointed star from memory, which was all that was required in the villages. He had a seamed, wind-burnt face, a shock of thick grey hair, wrinkles at the corners of his eyes. Though a big man, 6 feet tall, he had a way of hunching forward as he walked that made him seem much shorter. His hands were large and leathery, with red knuckles and dirt beneath the nails, and he had the biggest feet that Brian had ever seen, bare and black and hard as horn. "I have not worn a shoe in 20 years, he told Brian. "The first year I had more blisters than I had toes, and my soles would bleed like pigs whenever I trod on a hard stone. But I prayed, and the cobbler above turned my skin to leather."
"There is no cobbler above," Podrick protested.
"There is, lad, though you may call him by another name. Tell me, which of the 7 gods do you love best?"
"The warrior," said Podrick without a moment's hesitation.
Brain cleared her throat. "At evenfall, my father's septon always said that there was but one god. One god with 7 aspects. That's so, my lady, and you are right to point it out. But the mystery of the 7 who are one is not easy for simple folk to grasp, and I am nothing if not simple, so I speak of 7 gods. Meribald turned back to Podrick. "I have never known a boy who did not love the warrior. I am old, though, and being old, I love the smith. Without his labor, what would the warrior defend? Every town has a smith, and every castle. They make the ploughs we need to plant our crops, the nails we use to build our ships, iron shoes to save the hooves of our faithful horses, the bright swords of our lords. No one could doubt the value of a smith, and so we name one of the 7 in his honour, but we might as easily have called him the farmer, or the fisherman, the carpenter, or the cobbler. What he works at makes no matter. What matters is he works. The father rules, the warrior fights, the smith labours, and together they perform all that is rightful for a man. Just as the smith is one aspect of the Godhead, the cobbler is one aspect of the smith. It was he who heard my prayer and healed my feet." "The gods are good," Sir Hyle said in a dry voice, "but why trouble them when you might just have kept your shoes? Going barefoot was my penance. Even holy septons can be sinners, and my flesh was weak as weak could be. I was young and full of sap, and the girls. A septon can seem as gallant as a prince, if he is the only man you know who has ever been more than a mile from your village. I would recite to them from the seven-pointed star. The maiden's book worked best. Oh, I was a wicked man before I threw away my shoes. It shames me to think of all the maidens I deflowered. Brain shifted in the saddle uncomfortably, thinking back to the camp below the walls of Highgarden and the wager Sir Hyle and the others had made to see who could bed her first. "We're looking for a maiden," confided Podrick Payne, "a high-born girl of 3 and 10 with auburn hair." "I had understood that you were seeking outlaws." "Them too," Podrick admitted. "Most travellers do all they can to avoid such men," said Septon Meribald. "Yet you would seek them out." "We only seek one outlaw," Brain said, "the hound." "So Sir Hyle told me. May the seven save you, child. It said he leaves a trail of butchered babes and ravished maids behind him. The mad dog of salt pans, I have heard him called. What would good folk want with such a creature?" "The maid that Podrick spoke of may be with him." "Truly? Then we must pray for the poor girl." "And for me," thought Brian, "a prayer for me as well. Ask the crone to raise her lamp and lead me to the Lady Sansa, and the warrior to give strength to my arms that I might defend her." She did not say the words aloud, though, not where Hyle Hunt might hear her and mock her for her woman's weakness. With Septon Meribald afoot and his donkey bearing such a heavy load, the going was slow all that day. They did not take the main road west, the road that Brian had once ridden with Sir Jamie when they came the other way to find Maidenpool sacked and full of corpses. Instead, they struck off toward the northwest, following the shore of the Bay of Crabs on a crooked track so small that it did not appear on either of Sir Hyle's precious sheepskin maps. The steep hills, black bogs, and piney woods of Crackclaw Point were nowhere to be found this side of Maidenpool. The lands they travelled through were low and wet, a wilderness of sandy dunes and salt marshes beneath a vast blue-grey vault of sky. The road was prone to vanishing amongst the reeds and tidal pools, only to appear again a mile farther on. Without Meribald, Brian knew, they surely would have lost their way. The ground was often soft, so in places the septon would walk ahead, tapping with his quarterstaff to make certain of the footing. There were no trees for leagues around, just sea and sky and sand. No land could have been more different from Tarth, with its mountains and waterfalls, its high meadows and shadowed vales. Yet this place had its own beauty, Brain thought. They crossed a dozen slow-flowing streams alive with frogs and crickets, watched terns floating high above the bay, heard the sandpipers calling from amongst the dunes. Once a fox crossed their path and set Meribald's dog to barking wildly. And there were people, too. Some lived amongst the reeds in houses built of mud and straw, whilst others fished the bay in leather coracles and built their homes on rickety wooden stilts above the dunes. Most seemed to live alone, out of sight of any human habitation but their own. They seemed a shy folk for the most part, but near midday the dog began to bark again, and three women emerged from the reeds to give Meribald a woven basket full of clams. He gave each of them an orange in return, though clams were as common as mud in this world, and oranges were rare and costly. One of the women was very old, one was heavy with child, and one was a girl as fresh and pretty as a flower in spring. When Meribald took them off to hear their sins, Sir Hyle chuckled and said, "It would seem the gods walk with us, at least the maiden, the mother, and the crone." Podrick looked so astonished that Brain had to tell him, "No, there were only three marsh women." Afterward, when they resumed their journey, she turned to the septon and said, "These people live less than a day's ride from Maidenpool, and yet the fighting has not touched them." "They have little to touch, my lady. Their treasures are shells and stones and leather boats, their finest weapons knives of rusted iron. They are born, they live, they love, they die. They know Lord Mouton rules their lands, but few have ever seen him, and Riverrun and King's Landing are only names to them." "And yet they know the gods," said Brian. That is your work, I think. How long have you walked the Riverlands? It will be 40 years soon, the Septon said, and his dog gave a loud bark. From Maidenpool to Maidenpool. My circuit takes me half a year and oft times more. But I will not say I know the Trident. I glimpse the castles of the great lords only at a distance. But I know the market towns and holdfasts, the villages too small to have a name, the hedges and the hills, the rills where a thirsty man can drink, and the caves where he can shelter. And the roads the small folk use, the crooked, muddy tracks that do not appear on parchment maps, I know them too. He chuckled. I should. My feet have trod every mile of them 10 times over. The back roads are the ones the outlaws use, and the caves would make fine places for hunted men to hide. A prickle of suspicion made Brian wonder just how well Sir Hyle knew this man. It must make for a lonely life, Septon. The 7 are always with me, said Menebold, and I have my faithful servant and dog.
Does your dog have a name? Asked Podrick Payne.
He must, said Menebold, but he is not my dog, not him. The dog barked and wagged his tail. He was a huge, shaggy creature, 10 stone of dog at least, but friendly.
Who does he belong to? Asked Podrick.
Why, to himself, and to the 7. As to his name, he has not told me what it is. I call him Dog.
Oh!
Podrick did not know what to make of a dog named Dog, plainly. The boy chewed on that a while, then said,
I used to have a dog when I was little. I called him Hero.
Was he?
Was he what?
A hero.
No, he was a good dog, though. He died.
Dog keeps me safe upon the roads, even in such trying times as these. Neither wolf nor outlaw dare molest me when Dog is at my side. The Septon frowned. The wolves have grown terrible of late. There are places where a man alone would do well to find a tree to sleep in. In all my years, the biggest pack I ever saw had fewer than 12 wolves in it, but the great pack that prowls along the Trident now numbers in the hundreds. Have you come on them yourself? Sir Hyle asked. I have been spared that, 7 save me, but I have heard them in the night, and more than once. So many voices, a sound to curdle a man's blood. It even set Dog to shivering, and Dog has killed 12 wolves. He ruffled the dog's head. Some will tell you that they are demons. They say the pack is led by a monstrous she-wolf, a stalking shadow, grim and grey and huge. They would tell you that she has been known to bring an aurochs down all by herself, that no trap nor snare can hold her, that she fears neither steel nor fire, slays any wolf that tries to mount her, and devours no other flesh but man. Sir Hyle Hunt laughed. Now you've done it, Septon. Poor Podrick's eyes are big as boiled eggs.
They're not, said Podrick, indignant.
Dog barked. That night they made a cold camp in the dunes. Brian sent Podrick walking by the shore to find some driftwood for a fire, but he came back empty-handed with mud up to his knees.
The tide's out, sir, my lady. There's no water, only mudflats.
Stay off the mud, child, counselled Septon Merribald. The mud is not fond of strangers. If you walk in the wrong place, it will open up and swallow you.
It's only mud, insisted Podrick,
until it fills your mouth and starts creeping up your nose. Then it's death. He smiled to take the chill off his words. Wipe off that mud and have a slice of orange, lad. The next day was more of the same. They broke their fast on salt cod and more orange slices, and were on their way before the sun was wholly risen, with a pink sky behind them and a purple sky ahead. Dog led the way, sniffing at every clump of reeds and stopping every now and then to piss on one. He seemed to know the road as well as Merribald. The cries of terns shivered through the morning air as the tide came rushing in. Near midday they stopped at a tiny village, the first they had encountered, where 8 of the stilt houses loomed above a small stream. The men were out fishing in their coracles, but the women and young boys clambered down dangling rope ladders and gathered around Septon Merribald to pray. After the service he absolved their sins and left them with some turnips, a sack of beans, and 2 of his precious oranges. Back on the road, the Septon said, We would do well to keep a watch tonight, my friends. The villagers say they've seen three broken men skulking round the dunes west of the old watchtower. Only three? Sahail smiled. Three is honey to our swords, wench. They're not like to trouble armed men. Unless they're starving, the Septon said. There is food in these marshes, but only for those with the eyes to find it. And these men are strangers here, survivors from some battle. If they should accost us, sir, I beg you, leave them to me. What will you do with them? Feed them. Ask them to confess their sins, so that I might forgive them. Invite them to come with us to the quiet isle. That's as good as inviting them to slit our throats as we sleep, Heil Hunt replied. Lord Randall has better ways to deal with broken men. Steel and hempen rope.
Sir, m'lady, said Podrick, is a broken man an outlaw?
More or less, Rain answered. Septon Meribald disagreed. More less than more. There are many sorts of outlaws, just as there are many sorts of birds. A sandpiper and a sea eagle both have wings, but they are not the same. The singers love to sing of good men forced to go outside the law to fight some wicked lord, but most outlaws are more like this ravening hound than they are the lightning lord. They are evil men driven by greed, soured by malice, despising the gods and caring only for themselves. Broken men are more deserving of our pity, though they may be just as dangerous. Almost all are common-born, simple folk, who had never been more than a mile from the house where they were born, until the day some lord came round to take them off to war. Poorly shod and poorly clad, they march away beneath his banners, oft-times with no better arms than a sickle or a sharpened hoe, or a maul they made themselves by lashing a stone to a stick with strips of hide. Brothers march with brothers, sons with fathers, friends with friends. They've heard the songs and stories, so they go off with eager hearts, dreaming of the wonders they will see, of the wealth and glory they will win. War seems a fine adventure, the greatest most of them will ever know. Then they get a taste of battle. For some, that one taste is enough to break them. Others go on for years until they lose count of all the battles they have fought in. But even a man who has survived 100 fights can break in his 101st. Brothers watch their brothers die. Fathers lose their sons. Friends see their friends trying to hold their entrails in after they've been gutted by an axe. They see the lord who led them here cut down, and some other lord shouts that they are his now. They take a wound, and when that's still half healed, they take another. There is never enough to eat. Their shoes fall to pieces from the marching. Their clothes are torn and rotting, and half of them are shitting in their breeches from drinking bad water. If they want new boots or a warmer cloak, or maybe a rusted iron half-helm, they need to take them from a corpse. And before long they are stealing from the living, too, from the small folk, whose lands they're fighting in, men very like the men they used to be. They slaughter their sheep and steal their chickens, and from there it's just a short step to carrying off their daughters, too. And one day they look around and realize all their friends and kin are gone, that they are fighting beside strangers beneath a banner that they hardly recognize. They don't know where they are or how to get back home, and the lord they're fighting for does not know their names. Yet here he comes, shouting for them to form up to make a line with their spears and scythes and sharpened hoes, to stand their ground. And the knights come down on them, faceless men clad all in steel, and the iron thunder of their charge seems to fill the world. And the man breaks. He turns and runs, or crawls off afterward over the corpses of the slain, or steals away in the black of night, and he finds some place to hide. All thought of home is gone by then, and kings and lords and gods mean less to him than a haunch of spoiled meat that will let him live another day, or a skin of bad wine that might drown his fear for a few hours. The broken man lives from day to day, from meal to meal, more beast than man. Lady Brian is not wrong. In times like these, the traveller must beware of broken men and fear them, but he should pity them as well.
When Maribald was finished, a profound silence fell upon their little band. Brian could hear the wind rustling through a clump of pussy willows, and farther off the faint cry of a loon. She could hear Dog panting softly as he loped along beside the septon and his donkey, tongue lolling from his mouth. The quiet stretched and stretched until finally she said, "How old were you when they marched you off to war?"
"Why, no older than your boy," Maribald replied. "Too young for such in truth, but my brothers were all going, and I would not be left behind. William said I could be his squire, though Will was no knight, only a potboy armed with a kitchen knife he'd stolen from the inn. He died upon the stepstones, and never struck a blow. It was fever did for him and for my brother Robin. Owen died from a mace that split his head apart, and his friend John Pox was hanged for rape."
"The War of the Ninepenny Kings?" asked Heil Hunt.
"So they called it, though I never saw a king nor earned a penny. It was a war, though. That it was."
Davos. The cell was warmer than any cell had a right to be. It was dark, yes. Flickering orange light fell through the ancient iron bars from the torch in the sconce on the wall outside, but the back half of the cell remained drenched in gloom. It was dank as well, as might be expected on an isle such as Dragonstone, where the sea was never far, and there were rats, as many as any dungeon could expect to have, and a few more besides. But Davos could not complain of chill. The smooth stony passages beneath the great mass of Dragonstone were always warm, and Davos had often heard it said they grew warmer the farther down one went. He was well below the castle, he judged, and the wall of his cell often felt warm to his touch when he pressed a palm against it. Perhaps the old tales were true, and Dragonstone was built with the stones of hell. He was sick when they first brought him here. The cough that had plagued him since the battle grew worse, and a fever took hold of him as well. His lips broke with blood blisters, and the warmth of the cell did not stop his shivering. "I will not linger long," he remembered thinking. "I will die soon, here in the dark." Davos soon found that he was wrong about that, as about so much else. Dimly he remembered gentle hands and a firm voice, and young Maester Pylos looking down on him. He was given hot garlic broth to drink, and milk of the poppy to take away his aches and shivers. The poppy made him sleep, and while he slept, they leeched him to drain off the bad blood, or so he surmised by the leech marks on his arms when he woke. Before very long, the coughing stopped, the blisters vanished, and his broth had chunks of whitefish in it and carrots and onions as well. And one day he realized that he felt stronger than he had since Black Betha shattered beneath him and flung him into the river. He had two jailers to tend him. One was broad and squat, with thick shoulders and huge strong hands. He wore a leather brigantine dotted with iron studs, and once a day brought Davos a bowl of oaten porridge. Sometimes he sweetened it with honey or poured in a bit of milk. The other jailer was older, stooped and sallow, with greasy, unwashed hair and pebble skin. He wore a doublet of white velvet with a ring of stars worked upon the breast in golden thread. It fit him badly, being both too short and too loose, and was soiled and torn besides. He would bring Davos plates of meat and mash, or fish stew, and once even half a lamprey pie. The lamprey was so rich he could not keep it down, but even so it was a rare treat for a prisoner in a dungeon. Neither sun nor moon shone in the dungeons. No windows pierced the thick stone walls. The only way to tell day from night was by his jailers. Neither man would speak to him, though he knew they were no mutes. Sometimes he heard them exchange a few brusque words as the watch was changing. They would not even tell him their names, so he gave them names of his own. The short, strong one he called Porridge, the stooped, sallow one, Lamprey, for the pie. He marked the passage of days by the meals they brought, and by the changing of the torches in the sconce outside his cell. A man grows lonely in the dark, and hungers for the sound of a human voice. Davis would talk to the jailers whenever they came to his cell, whether to bring him food or change his slops pail. He knew they would be deaf to pleas for freedom or mercy. Instead, he asked them questions, hoping perhaps one day one might answer.
"What news of the war?" he asked. "And is the king well?"
He asked after his son Devon, and the Princess Shireen, and Salador San.
"What is the weather like?" he asked. "And have the autumn storms begun yet? Do ships still sail the narrow sea?"
It made no matter what he asked, they never answered. Although sometimes Porridge gave him a look, and for half a heartbeat Davis would think he was about to speak. With Lamprey there was not even that much.
"I am not a man, Dim," Davis thought, "only a stone that eats and shits and speaks."
He decided after a while that he liked Porridge much the better. Porridge at least seemed to know he was alive, and there was a queer sort of kindness to the man. Davis suspected that he fed the rats. That was why there were so many. Once he thought he heard the jailer talking to them, as if they were children, but perhaps he'd only dreamed that.
"They do not mean to let me die," he realized. "They are keeping me alive for some purpose of their own."
He did not like to think what that might be. Lord Sunglass had been confined in the cells beneath Dragonstone for a time, as had Sir Hubbard Rampton's sons. All of them had ended on the pyre.
"I should have given myself to the sea," Davis thought, as he sat staring at the torch beyond the bars. "Or let the sail pass me by to perish on my rock. I would sooner feed crabs and flames."
Then one night, as he was finishing his supper, Davis felt a queer flush come over him. He glanced up through the bars, and there she stood, in shimmering scarlet, with her great ruby at her throat, her red eyes gleaming as bright as the torch that bathed her.
"Melisande," he said, with a calm he did not feel.
"Onion night," she replied, just as calmly, as if the two of them had met on a stair or in the yard and were exchanging polite greetings.
"Are you well?" "Better than I was." "Do you lack for anything?" "My king, my son, I lack for them."
He pushed the bowl aside and stood.
"Have you come to burn me?"
Her strange red eyes studied him through the bars.
"This is a bad place, is it not? A dark place and foul. The good sun does not shine here, nor the bright moon."
She lifted a hand toward the torch in the wall sconce.
"This is all that stands between you and the darkness, Onion Knight. This little fire, this gift of R'hllor. Shall I put it out?"
"No."
He moved towards the bars.
"Please."
He did not think he could bear that, to be left alone in utter blackness, with no one but the rats for company. The red woman's lips curved upward in a smile.
"So, you have come to love the fire, it would seem."
"I need the torch."
His hands opened and closed.
"I will not beggar, I will not. I am like this torch, Sir Davis. We are both instruments of R'hllor. We were made for a single purpose, to keep the darkness at bay. Do you believe that?"
"No."
Perhaps he should have lied and told her what she wanted to hear, but Davis was too accustomed to speaking truth.
"You are the mother of darkness. I saw that under Storm's End when you gave birth before my eyes."
"Is the brave Sir Onions so frightened of a passing shadow? Take heart, then. Shadows only live when given birth by light. And the king's fires burn so low, I dare not draw off any more to make another son. It might well kill him."
Melisande moved closer.
"With another man, though, a man whose flames still burn hot and high. If you truly wish to serve your king's cause, come to my chamber one night. I could give you pleasure such as you have never known. And with your life fire, I could make a horror. Davos retreated from her. I want no part of you, my lady, or your god. May the Seven protect me. Melisande sighed. They did not protect Gunther Sunglass. He prayed thrice each day, and bore 7 7-pointed stars upon his shield. But when R'hllor reached out his hand, his prayers turned to screams, and he burned. Why cling to these false gods?
I have worshipped them all my life.
All your life, Davos Seaworth, as we'll say, it was so yesterday. She shook her head sadly. You have never feared to speak the truth to kings. Why do you lie to yourself? Open your eyes, Sir Knight.
What is it you would have me see?
The way the world is made. The truth is all around you, plain to behold. The night is dark and full of terrors, the day bright and beautiful and full of hope. One is black, the other white. There is ice and there is fire, hate and love, bitter and sweet, male and female, pain and pleasure. Winter and summer, evil and good. She took a step toward him. Death and life. Everywhere opposites. Everywhere the war.
The war?
Asked Davos. The war, she affirmed. There are 2, Onion Knight. Not 7. Not 1. Not 100 or 1,000. 2. Do you think I cross half the world to put yet another vain king on yet another empty throne? The war has been waged since time began, and before it is done, all men must choose where they will stand. On one side is R'hllor, the Lord of Light, the Heart of Fire, the God of Flame and Shadow. Against him stands the Great Other, whose name may not be spoken. The Lord of Darkness, the Soul of Ice, the God of Night and Terror. Ours is not a choice between Baratheon and Lannister, between Greyjoy and Stark. It is death we choose, or life, darkness, or light. She clasped the bars of his cell with her slender white hands. The great ruby at her throat seemed to pulse with its own radiance. So tell me, Sir Davos Seaworth, and tell me truly, does your heart burn with the shining light of R'hllor, or is it black and cold and full of worms? She reached through the bars and laid 3 fingers upon his breast, as if to feel the truth of him through flesh and wool and leather.
My heart, Davos said slowly, is full of doubts.
Melisande sighed. Ah, Davos, the good knight is honest to the last, even in his day of darkness. It is well you did not lie to me. I would have known. The other servants often hide black hearts in gaudy light. Sir R'hllor gives his priests the power to see through their falsehoods. She stepped lightly away from the cell. Why did you mean to kill me?
I will tell you, said Davos, if you will tell me who betrayed me.
It could only have been Salador San, and yet even now he prayed it was not so. The Red Woman laughed.
No one betrayed you, Onion Knight. I saw your purpose in my flames.
The flames? If you can see the future in these flames, how is it that we burned upon the Blackwater? You gave my sons to the fire, my sons, my ship, my men, all burning.
Melisande shook her head.
You wrong me, Onion Knight. Those were no fires of mine. Had I been with you, your battle would have had a different ending. But his grace was surrounded by unbelievers, and his pride proved stronger than his faith. His punishment was grievous, but he has learned from his mistake.
Were my sons no more than a lesson for a king, then? Davos felt his mouth tighten.
It is night in your seven kingdoms now, the Red Woman went on, but soon the sun will rise again. The war continues, Davos Seaworth, and some will soon learn that even an ember in the ashes can still ignite a great blaze. The old maester looked at Stannis and saw only a man. You see a king. You are both wrong. He is the Lord's chosen, the warrior of fire. I have seen him leading the fight against the dark. I have seen it in the flames. The flames do not lie. Else you would not be here. It is written in prophecy as well. When the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall be born again amidst smoke and salt to wake dragons out of stone. The bleeding star has come and gone, and Dragonstone is the place of smoke and salt. Stannis Baratheon is Azor Ahai reborn. Her red eyes blaze like twin fires and seem to stare deep into his soul. You do not believe me. You doubt the truth of R'hllor even now, yet have served him all the same, and will serve him again. I shall leave you here to think on all that I have told you, and because R'hllor is the source of all good, I shall leave the torch as well.
With a smile and a swirl of scarlet skirts, she was gone. Only her scent lingered after. That and the torch. Davos lowered himself to the floor of the cell and wrapped his arms about his knees. The shifting torchlight washed over him. Once Melisandre's footsteps faded away, the only sound was the scrabbling of rats.
Ice and fire, he thought, black and white, dark and light.
Davos could not deny the power of her guard. He had seen the shadow crawling from Melisandre's womb, and the priestess knew things she had no way of knowing.
She saw my purpose in her flames.
It was good that Sala had not sold him, but the thought of the Red Woman spying out his secrets with her fires disquieted him more than he could say.
And what did she mean when she said that I had served her God and would serve him again?
He did not like that either. He lifted his eyes to stare up at the torch. He looked for a long time, never blinking, watching the flames shift and shimmer. He tried to see beyond them, to peer beyond the fiery curtain and glimpse whatever lived back there. But there was nothing, only fire, and after a time his eyes began to water. God blind and tired, Davos curled up on the straw and gave himself to sleep. 3 days later, well, porridge had come thrice, and lamprey twice, Davos heard voices outside his cell. He sat up at once, his back to the stone wall, listening to the sounds of struggle. This was new, a change in his unchanging world. The noise was coming from the left, where the steps led up to daylight. He could hear a man's voice pleading and shouting. Madness, the man was saying as he came into view, dragged along between two guardsmen with fiery hearts on their breasts. Porridge went before them, jangling a ring of keys, and Sir Axel Florent walked behind. Axel, the prisoner asked desperately, for the love you bear me, unhand me. You cannot do this. I'm no traitor. He was an older man, tall and slender, with silvery grey hair, a pointed beard, and a long, elegant face, twisted in fear.
Where is Selyse? Where is the Queen? I demand to see her. The others take you all. Release me.
The guards paid no mind to his outcries.
Here?
Porridge asked in front of the cell. Davos got to his feet. For an instant he considered trying to rush them when the door was open, but that was madness. There were too many. The guards wore swords, and Porridge was strong as a bull. Sir Axel gave the jailer a curt nod. "Let the traitors enjoy each other's company."
"I am no traitor!"
screeched the prisoner as Porridge was unlocking the door. Though he was plainly dressed in grey wool doublet and black breeches, his speech marked him as high-born.
"His birth will not serve him here," thought Davis.
Porridge swung the bars wide. Sir Axel gave a nod, and the guards flung their charge in headlong. The man stumbled and might have fallen, but Davis caught him. At once he wrenched away and staggered back toward the door, only to have it slammed in his pale, pampered face.
"No!" he shouted. "No!"
All the strength suddenly left his legs, and he slid slowly to the floor, clutching at the iron bars. Sir Axel, Porridge, and the guards had already turned to leave.
"You cannot do this!"
the prisoner shouted at their retreating backs.
"I am the king's hand!"
It was then that Davis knew him.
"You are Alastair Florent."
The man turned his head.
"Who?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
Lord Alastair blinked.
"Seaworth? The Onion Knight? You tried to murder Melisande."
Davis did not deny it.
"At Storm's End, you wore red gold armor with inlaid lapis flowers on your breastplate."
He reached down a hand to help the other man to his feet. Lord Alastair brushed the filthy straw from his clothing.
I must apologize for my appearance, sir. My chests were lost when the Lannisters overran our camp. I escaped with no more than the mail on my back and the rings on my fingers."
"He still wears those rings," noted Davis, who had lacked even all of his fingers.
"No doubt some cook's boy or groom is prancing around King's Landing just now in my slashed velvet doublet and jewelled cloak,"
Lord Alastair went on, oblivious.
"But war has its horrors, as all men know. No doubt you have suffered your own losses."
"My ship," said Davis, "all my men, four of my sons."
"Oh, may the Lord of Light lead them through the darkness to a better world," the other man said.
"May the Father judge them justly, and the Mother grant them mercy,"
Davis thought, but he kept his prayer to himself. The Seven had no place on Dragonstone now.
"My own son is safe at Brightwater," the Lord went on, "but I lost a nephew on the Fury, Sir Emery, my brother Ryan's son."
It had been Sir Emery Florent who led them blindly up the Blackwater Rush, with all oars pulling, paying no heed to the small stone towers at the mouth of the river. Davis was not like to forget him.
"My son Marek was your nephew's oarmaster."
He remembered his last sight of Fury engulfed in wildfire.
"Has there been any word of survivors?"
"The Fury burned and sank with all hands," his lordship said. "Your son and my nephew were lost with countless other good men. The war itself was lost that day, sir."
"This man is defeated."
Davis remembered Melisande's talk of embers in the ashes igniting great blazes.
"Small wonder he ended here." "His grace will never yield, my lord." "Folly, that's folly."
Lord Alastair sat on the floor again, as if the effort of standing for a moment had been too much for him.
"Stannis Baratheon will never sit the Iron Throne. Is it treason to say the truth? A bitter truth, but no less true for that. His feet is gone, save for the Lyseni, and Salazar Sam will flee at the first sight of a Lannister sail. Most of the lords who supported Stannis have gone over to Joffrey, or died. Even the lords of the Narrow Sea, the lord sworn to Dragonstone."
Lord Alastair waved his hand feebly.
"Lord Celtigar was captured and bent the knee. Monfort Velaryon died with his ship. The Red Woman burned Sunglass, and Lord Bar-Eamon is 15 fat and feeble. Those are your lords of the Narrow Sea.
Only the strength of House Florin is left to Stannis, against all the might of High Garden, Sunspear, and Castle Rock, and now most of the Stormlords as well.